The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Benjamin Cohen, author of the fascinating book My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. We'll also have a visit from our Mevinah on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, Israel correspondent Rabbi David Wilfond from Jerusalem, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Living in Arizona as I do, I simply have to talk about immigration this morning because it is, was, and has always been a Jewish issue. And right now, my state seems bent on committing economic suicide in order to demonize people who have immigrated to America. Just in case you've been living on a desert island for the last week that didn't have internet connectivity, the august Arizona State Legislature has passed, and our governor for the moment, Jan Brewer, has signed a new law, SB 1070, the broadest and most stringent and perhaps most dangerous immigration law in many decades in America. It gave the power to state and local police to detain and arrest and incarcerate anyone suspected of being in the country illegally, or anyone they suspect of being an immigrant who does not have identification papers on them. Even before the law passed, President Obama, a professor of constitutional law before he entered politics, called Governor Brewer and urged her not to sign the law, an unusual step for a president to take. He noted it was very likely to be overturned by the courts. Well, she signed it, and the law will take effect in August. The controversy that immediately embroiled our state has been something to see and hear, but not something good. Organizations throughout the country have begun to pull conventions from Arizona, viewing the law as a racist and fascist approach to an ongoing immigration debate. Cardinal Roger Mahoney of Los Angeles called the measure's provision to allow police to demand documents from anyone suspected of being an illegal immigrant Nazism. While there have been a number of failed efforts to fix our badly broken immigration system over the years, none have really been fully implemented, and recently they can't even pass the Congress. Well, I'm not going to play out all the arguments about SB 1070 here on Too Jewish. Suffice it to say, this is a stupid law passed by ideologues who like to blame all of society's problems on immigrants. Well, it's an old issue where Latinos are concerned. In fact, it reminds me of a Tom Lehrer song from around 1965 called George Murphy.
Should Americans pick crops? George says no, 'cause no one but a Mexican would stoop so low. And after all, even in Egypt, the pharaohs had to import Hebrew braceros.
That was Tom Lehrer, the great Jewish-American satirist, on a bit of the issue of immigration. Even in Egypt, the pharaohs had to import Hebrew braceros. Yes, the issue of illegal immigrants doing work that we don't want to do goes back a long way, and passing an idiotic law that creates a kind of permission to use police-state tactics to harass innocent people won't solve anything. Yes, immigration goes farther back even than John McCain's involvement with the issue, no matter how old he seems these days. You see, immigration is actually a kind of central motif of human life. Each of our lives is at heart a journey, and when those journeys take us across boundaries into new territories, we become immigrants. In effect, every one of us is a kind of emigrant first, leaving a childhood home, migrating out into the world to explore and discover what life will be. Over our lives, we become immigrants, that is, moving somewhere specific as well, establishing our place in the world in a new location. Judaism's understood the centrality of the migratory element from its very beginning. Every important figure in the Torah undergoes a major journey, immigrates from one culture to another, from one land to at least one other. The first Jew, Abraham, began this process by leaving at God's express command your land, your birthplace, the house of your father in Lech Lecha. The Passover Haggadah reminds us that our father Jacob was a wandering Aramean. Moses' son's very name reflects that he is Ger Hayiti Be'eretz Nochria, a stranger in a strange land. And Moses himself journeys from Egypt to the wilderness of Sinai not once but twice. First alone, to meet God at the burning bush, and then in the company of a whole migratory nation, the total population of the Israelite people, a theoretical transit of perhaps 2 million people across a desert to a promised land. Immigrants have a defined status in the Bible. The ger, the alien, and the ger toshav, the resident alien, are accorded protection under the law, just like the rest of us native-born types. My friends, from the days of the destruction of the first temple, we have been wandering Jews, and that's 2,600 years ago, living everywhere as settlers and immigrants and eventually permanent residents. Until modernity, we were not permitted true citizenship. We rarely had any sense of permanence in our adopted homes. In fact, our invitations to move to various lands and empires always had an expiration date. 700 years in Spain ended with the expulsion. 1,000 years in the Rhineland ended with Hitler. Every place in the diaspora became, as it was in Fiddler on the Roof, Anatevka, awaiting the Cossack sword and the next edict of expulsion. And you know, frequently we Jews were illegal immigrants too. From the Jews who thrived in Venice's Golden Age or lived in Shakespeare's England illegally, to the refugees the Haganah snuck into Palestine, we broke the law to find a safer, more prosperous place to live. Today, we thrive in this wonderful Golden Medina of America, the land we entered in large numbers seeking freedom and success. But we Jews know what it is to come to a new country, to be undocumented, to struggle at the margins of society in an uncertain status, to fear the very authorities entrusted with enforcing law and justice. So how do we respond to the cries that we're overrun with immigrants? Our security is endangered. Emergency rooms are drowning in the flood of uninsured illegals. Our schools are failing because they can't afford to educate illegal immigrant children. Well, here in Arizona, we live in the midst of a beautiful but dangerous desert bordering a strange land. 500,000 people cross the area of the U.S.-Mexican border right near me every year. Many more come across in neighboring areas. I personally have been in Altar, a central jump-off point for those crossing the border into America. For the Mexican economy, immigration is a major industry. There is no hint of restriction. Immigrants die in the desert hundreds a year crossing illegally. And that does not slow the tide at all. But for us, for the American economy, the workforce provided by immigrants is essential. There is not a construction site in the Southwest, I believe, that could function without some number of undocumented workers. A single roof would be hard to repair in my city if all the illegal immigrants were deported. Immigrants have been the engine of our American economy since its birth. Some send money home to Guatemala, just like my grandfather, later a Reform Movement rabbi and theologian, sent money home to Minsk. No matter how we eventually decide to face this challenge, we must remember an essential truth. You, me, all of us, we are all immigrants. And treating people brutally and without adequate civil rights or respect violates this in the stupidest and least ethical way. To play us in this morning, we offer a Sephardic song from the Jews of Spain. You know, Hispanic Jews. Open your closed door. It's both a love song and a kind of corrective metaphor for our current approach to immigration.
Abre tu puerta cerrada. Que en tu balcón luz no hay. El amor a ti te vela. Partimos rosa de aquí. mandi por la tura mosura. Como te la dio el Dios. La hermosura tuya es pura. La merezco lo solo yo.
Abre tu puerta cerrada, open your closed door, as sung by Yehoram Gaon in Ladino. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Binyamin Cohen, the editor and writer who's the author of a highly entertaining book called My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. Find out what motivated him to plunge into exploring contemporary Christianity in the South in a few moments right here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We're delighted to welcome our guest to Too Jewish this morning, Binyamin Cohen. He's the son of an Orthodox rabbi who married the converted daughter of a former Christian minister, founder and editor of the award-winning national magazine American Jewish Life and the online magazine Jews Week. He has written for the Huffington Post, the Daily Beast, the Washington Post, and Slate, the online magazine. Prior to that, he edited Torah from Dixie, thoughts on the weekly Parshat HaShavua, the Torah portion, later turned into a book with the same name. He's now the content director for Mother Nature Network and Environmental News Network, and the author of the fascinating book, My Jesus Year. Good morning.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Doing well. Well, you know, just your bio is pretty good.
I got tired just listening to it.
How do your parents feel about that?
Well, you know, when you condense, you know, 15 years of work into four sentences, I guess it sounds like a lot. I guess that would work for anybody.
That's, I like that. All right, so let's talk about My Jesus Year. I've read a lot of interesting books. Bruce Feiler walked the Bible, and there's that terrific book about living the Bible. But where did you get this idea?
Well, yeah, I've lived my entire life in the Bible Belt in Atlanta, Georgia, and there's churches on every street corner. You know, there's more churches than Starbucks here. You know, sometimes you walk inside a church and there's a Starbucks inside the church. So it's really everywhere you go, there's just churches and churches and churches on multiple churches on the same street corner, and the parking lots are almost always full. And, you know, at synagogues, it's not necessarily the case. So, you know, if it's a bar mitzvah, there's a big crowd. If it's the high holidays, there's a big crowd. But, you know, on a regular weekend, it's not always a big crowd. And I was wondering, what are people doing inside church that's so much, for lack of a better word, fun, that's bringing people back every Sunday? And what can I learn as a Jew on an individual level to get more jazzed about my Judaism? And what can the community, the Jewish community as a whole, learn to market themselves better or have better services or whatnot to get more people to come to services on a regular basis?
So we'll get to the answers later, but I just have to confess, I spent 4 years in Spartanburg, South Carolina as the rabbi there, which is not terribly far from Atlanta. Remember, the first question anybody asked you in the South was, what church do you belong to? Right after your name. And if you said, I belong to the synagogue, that was fine. The problem was if you said, well, I don't do that.
I find people in the South, I mean, you've lived here, so you would know, people in the South who are religious, they really feel an affinity for other religious people. And I, in many ways, I feel like I have a lot in common with him. You know, give or take a Jesus, you know, we're both very religious people. You know, religion is a daily part of our life, et cetera. And it's not so strange to them. I mean, they say to me, I've had lots of people at church say to me, you're the first Jew I ever met. And, you know, it's because I'm wearing a skull cap on my head. But I said to them, I'm sure you've met, you know, I'm sure you have a doctor. I'm sure you have a lawyer. I'm sure you've met other Jews before.
I'm sure you bought clothes from a Jew before.
Right, exactly.
In the South. Well, we will talk much more with Benjamin Cohen about some of the startling experiences he had following Christianity around the South when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or akvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O, Jewish Radio, or call 520-327-4501, or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. In the spirit of responding to the immigration law madness here in Arizona and exploring our Jewish-Latino connections in a positive way, here's a cut from the unusual fusion group Hip Hop Judios and their harshly funny song, Nose Jobs.
About time for you to be bailing out of the community and race that you come from. Your face gotta change, son. Now the black girl wants to get a lip tuck. Says take away my hips so I have a slim figure. The white girl says my hips are not big enough. Yo, doc, some collagen to make my lips bigger. Tori Spelling, Michael Jackson said the way that we ought to be acting up. My nose is like a pickup truck. It gets the girls the air. It can never compare to what a wasp's got. I ain't no have-not. Turn off the MTV and sing along with me. Like a ham triple decker. Polly wants to be a cracker. If you let her see for me, the bigger the nose, the better. They say the whiter, the brighter. Oh yeah, well that's tough. Sometimes I think that I'm not yet enough. What generation said I got a vocation? Hablo Espanol, I'm Alsaceration. All these celebrities are selling millions of records, claiming no responsibility. A girl sees your TV show. She's only 6, says, Mama, I don't like my nose. Why'd you have to go mess up the child's head so you can get another gold waterbed? You fake head, contact wearing liposuction, collarbone exhibit.
The song Nose Jobs from the Jewish Latino fusion group Hip Hop Judios. We welcome our special correspondent from Jerusalem in Israel, Rabbi David Wilfon. Lag BaOmer is coming up, and I believe you can tell us a little bit about the experience, the very unusual experience that one can have at Lag BaOmer at this special 33rd day in the counting of the Omer, this unusual period of the year.
I want to tell you just a little story. One time I was living on a kibbutz. I was 19 years old, and it was Lag BaOmer, and it was a Saturday night, and the buses were beginning, and this friend said, hey, let's go join all those crowds and go up to Mount Meron. So we took a bus from our kibbutz near Jerusalem, went to Tel Aviv to try to get a bus up to Mount Meron, and we got there. They said all the buses are full and gone, but there's some like religious, like ultra-Orthodox buses. You can join one of these. So we got into a bus. It was men in the front, women in the back, and there's a lot of Sephardic Jews who were like getting newly in touch with their roots. And they were driving, listening to Nigunim all the way up, singing songs. And it must have been like the middle of the night, like 2 o'clock at night. We're like weaving through the mountains of the Galilee. And we stop. And everybody gets out. And in like a field, there's an entrance to a cave. And we go into this cave. It's huge. And on the floor are all these carpets. Around the walls are all these candles. A big cave with about 100 people in it. And we all sit down on the floors, on the carpets. It turns out this is one of the caves that, according to tradition anyway, Shimon Bar Yochai met with various other students during the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And this is where they wrote and taught the Zohar for the first time. This little cave is called the Idra Zutra. And in this cave, we took turns. People, most of them much older people, they stood up and they would read the Zohar in Aramaic and then translate into Hebrew. Now, I obviously didn't understand the Aramaic. I kind of barely understood the Hebrew. And the thing went on all night long, and it was wild, these teachings and then singing and teaching and singing. At a certain point, somebody said, everybody out of the cave. It was just before sunrise. And we went out of the cave as like the sun was barely rising over the mountains. And we had like a sunrise shacharit. And the women who were there were making foods that had like different mystical interpretations, like the name of the food, like fish is dag in Hebrew, which is seven. And seven is a very symbolic number of creation. There's all these different mystical foods connected to Lag BaOmer. And I think I was 19 years old in this experience. It was my first time ever encountering anything mystical, and I said, wow, I will have to go and learn a little bit of Kabbalah, of mysticism and Hasidut. And that experience of that Lag BaOmer really launched me on a path that influenced me in my rabbinic studies and graduate studies that I did at Hebrew U. So I just wanted to share a story of a very unusual Lag BaOmer all night long in a cave somewhere near Mount Meron.
Wonderful story. Thanks, Gingy. We will get more stories, mystical and otherwise, next week.
Okay. Be well and a happy Lag BaOmer to everyone.
We welcome our Bavinta, our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Lenerman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we started talking last week. We started with taxes and ended up with how where we give money reflects our values, or how people like to control where the money goes even after they give it nowadays.
Well, it's money and control are, handmaidens of each other. It's pretty important for people who have worked so hard to create their estates to be able to feel that not just in their life, but for many people in their passing, that their money will go to further causes that really represent their values. That's why we have community foundations, legacy planning. The Jewish Community Foundation is a very good example. It services not just organizations, but individuals and families that create funds to promote many things in their passing, as well as in their life. But the question is, what would the world look like if all of Jewish giving was individualized so that people could only show their interest, and how would that affect the bigger picture? Some people complain, Rabbi, that, some of the organizational Jewish structures have outlived them, their purpose or use, but from a philanthropic standpoint, they still, tend to monitor and centralize a lot of the distribution of dollars for the larger Jewish world. So, it's really a good, it's a question that has to be looked at, because I think some of the old models of giving are not as effective. And
yeah,
certainly,
I think people don't like giving to some clearinghouse that says it's going to distribute the money equitably and keep some for administration. I think that's a general principle. It used to be, this is an efficient model.
Exactly.
I don't think people like that anymore, and you can see that in the number of people who give to a federation. While the dollars may go up, and lately they've been going down, the number of people, the number of Jews who actually give has been declining for a long time.
Well, there's that. I mean, and I think you can make parallel comparisons probably between United Way, for example, and other things. You're absolutely right. People want a voice in where their money's going. That's number one. Number two is things like many of the disappointments that people have had to see how much of their dollars is actually going towards non-philanthropic causes, but administration and salaries has also been a disincentive. People get really frustrated. But I think the question also then has to be raised, so how do we guarantee that certain aspects of the Jewish world will be taken care of if we don't have a specific amount going to those areas, whether it's local, national, global? You know, what if there's no longer a certain amount of money going towards, let's say, Israel, for example, because people individually would rather keep it locally in their communities? Then what happens? I mean, these are really broad questions.
Yeah, interesting questions. I mean, you know, the truth is that any model for how you give is a model, and it'll work for a certain period of time, and then it won't.
I think that's true, and I think we have to have faith in the generations and the young leaders that are coming up, who are being questioning these very things as they start to contribute, that they are going to come up with their own new set of paradigms and solutions.
And new sets of organizations and new ways of approaching problems that maybe don't include the old, and sometimes old organizations need to go away.
Perhaps we will see cyber dollars become, you know, the next best thing to philanthropy.
Yeah. The answer really is not how the money is given, but what it's focused on and how that helps to improve the world.
I would agree.
Thanks, Amy. We'll talk next week.
You bet.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
What a fabulous spring we've had here.
I'll tell you, this is a great time to be a chef. We're getting the most beautiful vegetables from our gardeners right now. Little fava beans, spring peas, little tiny delicate leeks, great baby carrots with their little green tufts, all the herbs, and then the wild things from the sea. Unbelievable Alaskan wild halibut right now. Then we're getting spring lamb, and this is the time to be a chef, and this is the time to eat out.
And the time to eat at Janos, I would say. Best restaurant I can think of. What's the phone number?
615-6100. Rabbi, you can go to our website. All of our menus are on our website, and you can make reservations. Janos.com.
So that's JANOS.com. We will see you there for a great spring dining experience. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Poland the last couple of weeks in the wake of the tragic air crash that killed the Polish president, Kaczynski. You've been on that plane, actually, you mentioned off mic.
Yes, actually. In fact, I'm not sure that it was the same plane. I think they have two or three and they're stable, but they're the same aircraft type, the Tupolev 154, which are used to ferry Polish VIPs around. The same way we have a couple of planes
that are Air Force One.
At least
One,
we used to right have now, a couple of planes designated Air Force One, which carry around various bigwigs, not necessarily the president. And when they're anyone other than the president is in them, they're not referred to as Air Force One. But in any case, I once accompanied the then foreign minister of Poland, Bronisław Geremek, who was chairman in office of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, for which, as you know, I worked in Vienna for many years. We were going on a high-level trip to visit several capitals in Central Asia, and the logistics would have been impossible without having a dedicated aircraft. So Polish Air Force flew this plane in the same way that they flew this delegation to Katyn, and Luckily, there were no mishaps on that flight. We had perfect weather, and I felt like we were in very competent hands, etc. But the fact that there was a Jewish foreign minister is interesting in a country that is known for its anti-Semitism. The fact is that in the immediate aftermath of communist rule, a lot of the liberals, the thinkers, the intellectuals were either Jews or half-Jews or people of Jewish ancestry. And certainly everybody in that category was somebody who would be seen by his or her fellow Poles as Jewish, even if they were an eighth Jewish. The Poles really internalized this sort of Nazi calculus about what makes somebody a Jew, and it's like any remote Jewish ancestry. That being said, you know, the stories of World War II are full of righteous Gentiles in Poland who hid Jewish children and Jewish families at the risk of their lives to save them from the Nazis. And there were lots of exceptions to the general rule that the Poles were not too friendly to Jews. That was probably truer of Polish peasants in the deep countryside in the late Middle Ages and the early modern period than it was of urban liberal intellectuals or whatever in the modern period. The most interesting thing about Poland is that virtually all of the real Jewish community was wiped out. People were 100% Jews. Some people came back. Some managed to survive in hiding. There wasn't much of a community left during the 50s and 60s and even 70s. But there was a huge interest in Poland, particularly as the communist period came to an end, in revisiting the past. And since the past included such a prominent role for Jews, the Poles themselves went on a journey to discover klezmer music, Yiddish literature, Yiddish theater, et cetera, et cetera. And they opened klezmer bands. I mean, they created klezmer bands, Yiddish theaters, et cetera, staffed either entirely or mainly by non-Jewish young Poles who wanted to revive this part of their country's culture, even though there weren't any Jews with whom to do it. So there's a fascinating kind of renaissance of what we think of as Jewish slash Yiddish culture in Poland, carried out almost entirely by non-Jews.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There is a revival of an interesting Jewish community in Poland. There's liberal congregations, Beit Warszawa in Warsaw. There's something going on in Krakow. You know, there is a bit of a Jewish community there, but it's all really pretty recent. And the non-Jew,
and tiny,
yeah, pretty small. It's growing, but, you know, if you have 10 people and you add 10 people, you've multiplied it by 100%. It's still pretty small. I do think it's just a very interesting phenomenon that you love the Jews when they're gone. We will talk next week, Tom. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The local bar was so sure its bartender was the strongest man around, they offered a standing $1,000 bet. The bartender would squeeze a lemon until all the juice ran into a glass, and then hand the lemon to a patron. Anyone who could squeeze even one more drop of juice out would win the money. Lots of people tried over the years, football players, weightlifters, longshoremen, but nobody could do it. One day, a scrawny little Jewish guy came into the bar wearing thick glasses and a polyester suit and said in a tiny, squeaky voice, "I'd like to try the bet." After the laughter died down, the bartender said, "Okay," grabbed a lemon and squeezed away. Then he handed the wrinkled remains of the rind to the Jewish fellow. But the crowd's laughter turned to total silence as the man clenched his fist around the lemon and six more drops fell into the glass. The crowd cheered. The bartender paid the $1,000, and he asked the little Jewish guy, "What do you do for a living? Are you a lumberjack, a weightlifter, what?" And the Jewish fellow replied, "I raise money for the Jewish Federation." I know that guy, actually. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We now welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. I've got another Helm story for us this week. This one was collected, I saw, by Stephen Schenken, though last week the story was collected by Joel Ben Izzy. And in this one, there was once this rather wealthy man in Chelm, wealthy by Chelm standards, and he one day decided he was going to hold a feast for all of his family and friends, and on the occasion of this feast, he had purchased a rather expensive barrel of wine, which he was going to tap just for the occasion. And he had it waiting in his basement for the day of the feast, and he had a friend staying with him who was from out of town, thus had a slightly different perspective than most people in Chelm. And one day, the friend was upstairs when he heard this moaning and wailing from down in the basement. Now, this happened to be the very day of the feast, and so the friend, hoping that something wasn't terribly wrong, he went running down the stairs into the cellar, and there he found his friend, the Chelmite, standing mourning, tears streaming down his face as he looked over that barrel of wine which he had purchased. And the friend said, "What's the matter?" And the Chelmite said, I just got this barrel, and it was so expensive, and I went to tap it, and it's almost empty. I can't believe it. What terrible luck." And the friend, who, you know, he wanted to be helpful, he started looking around to see why it was almost empty. And as he kind of crawled underneath the barrel, he happened to see there was a small hole with little drops of wine falling out. And he didn't know what could have caused it, but he stood up and he said, "My friend, I'm sorry to tell you that the reason is that for whatever reason, there's a hole underneath the barrel on the bottom." And the Chelmite looked at him as if he was a fool, and he said, "That can't be it." And the friend said, what do you mean it can't be it?" And the Chelmite said, "Don't you see? There's still a small puddle of wine on the very bottom of the barrel. And so clearly the hole can't be on the bottom. Rather, all the wine that's missing is from the top. So the hole must be somewhere near the top." And the friend looked at his Chelmite friend and knew not to press the matter.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll hear another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Sedra Behar B'Chukotai, the double portion at the end of the book of Leviticus. In these final portions of the middle of the Torah, there are interesting oddities and lessons both in the beginning and end of both portions. Behar begins with the statement God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, which is a seemingly unambiguous phrase. And at the end of the opening covenantal section of B'Chukotai, the Torah reiterates that God gave all the regulations and laws contained herein at Mount Sinai. Finally, B'Chukotai concludes the book of Vayikra by telling us these are the commandments God commanded Moses for all the Israelites on Mount Sinai. Well and good. So these rules of holiness and personal conduct must have been commanded at Mount Sinai. But earlier in Leviticus, it's made pretty clear that God actually gave most of these commandments not at Mount Sinai itself, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, as the people wandered around. In other words, the Israelites are not still at Mount Sinai at all. So what gives? This question troubles the rabbinic commentators who believe the Torah never wastes a phrase or makes a mistake. Their brilliant answer teaches us a profound truth. For Mount Sinai, they say, is not just a geographical location, not a simple matter of a mountain or even a place at all. Whenever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, observe religious rituals with sanctity and meaning, when we study Torah or work to perfect the world through tikkun olam, whenever we make the world a holier, more Jewish place, well then we are standing at Mount Sinai. Almost literally, as committed Jews, we take Mount Sinai with us, bringing God's very presence into the world. As we conclude the book of Leviticus, so focused on holiness, we learn that we can make our own lives holy as the revelation at Mount Sinai itself, simply by bringing Torah into each day. When we come back on To Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and find out what it's like to wander the blue highways of the Deep South as an obvious Jew exploring evangelical and fundamental Christian churches and groups. Learn from our guest, Binyamin Cohen, the author of My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith, how all that works when we come back on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A rabbi and two Jewish officials were arrested in Chicago for taking part in immigration reform protests. Rabbi Joshua Salter of Beth Shalom B'nai Zaken congregation on the Chicago South Side was among 24 people arrested outside a federal detention center, along with former two Jewish guests Jane Ramsey, executive director of the Chicago-based Jewish Council of Urban Affairs, and Tom Walsh, the organization's director of advocacy. They were cited for disorderly conduct for sitting on a street. Remember those sit-ins? Attempting to block a van carrying detainees from reaching the detention center. They were released later in the day. Their protest against the stringent and stupid new Arizona immigration law followed a rally and all-night vigil. At the prayer vigil, Rabbi Bruce Elder, a Jewish council board member and a classmate of mine in rabbinical school, said, "I'm not here to say shame on Arizona. I'm here to say shame on America for allowing Arizona to happen." Well, okay. The Jewish Council is a co-convener of We Were Strangers Too, the Jewish Campaign for Immigration Reform, with the Jewish Community Action and the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Frankly, I'm from Arizona, and I'm ashamed. In lighter news, in Israel, the population is now in great turmoil over the current ban on the importation or use of the new Apple iPad. You know, the large version of the iPod that is taking the techie world by storm. Apparently, the iPad places an undue strain on the Wi-Fi system in Israel that is so crucial to the functioning of Israeli business. Israel is the world's second largest developer of new software, for example, and the current iPad doesn't meet the stringent Israeli standards for Wi-Fi. Apple is working on the problem and promises a fix soon, but for the moment, Israelis are iPad-less. For a country that is so extraordinarily technophilic, filled with first adopters on new devices and technologies, this is indeed a hardship. May Apple find a way to meet the kashrut standards of Israel's Wi-Fi world speedily and soon. And Google has acquired its first Israeli company. It's buying the privately backed startup LabPixies, which develops personalized website gadgets for Google's personalized search page, iGoogle, and mobile devices. The deal has been estimated at about $25 million. It's the first deal for Google in Israel since launching a research and development center in 2005 there. LabPixies staff will be integrated into the Google Israel office based in Tel Aviv. Google Israel Managing Director Yossi Matthias said, "Google believes in Israeli innovation and creativity and will continue to strive for collaborations with local companies and startups." Ruth Nussbaum, former neighbor of Anne Frank's family, who later played a key role in the reform movement's embrace of Zionism, has died in Los Angeles. She was 98 years old. Born into a prosperous and assimilated Jewish family in Berlin, Ruth Nussbaum later studied language, philosophy, and art at universities in Berlin and Geneva. She and her daughter, from an early marriage, moved to Amsterdam in 1937. Among their neighbors was the Frank family, whose daughter Anne frequently visited. In 1938, Ruth married Max Nussbaum, a rising young reform rabbi in Berlin, with the eminent Rabbi Leo Beck officiating. In late 1940, as the war raged in Europe, the young Nussbaum family managed to acquire visas somehow and got into the United States. Rabbi Max Nussbaum was offered the pulpit at Temple Israel of Hollywood in 1942. He served there for 32 years until his death in 1974. I knew him and his wife Ruth. My father filled in as a cantor at Temple Israel at one time. The Nussbaums invented invested much of their time and energy in their two great passions, Zionism and the American Civil Rights Movement. Ruth Nussbaum was instrumental in the creation of the Association of Reformed Zionists of America, ARTSA. 5 years ago, ARTSA gave her a prestigious award, and Stanley Davids, then the organization's president, said Ruth played a pivotal role in helping to reshape the reform view of Zionism. In 1965, the Nussbaums welcomed Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to the pulpit of Temple Israel. Ruth Nussbaum was described by Rabbi John Rossoff of Temple Israel as perhaps the most remarkable person I've ever known. She was a historic figure, and she was our conscience. By the way, in the interest of full disclosure, Rabbi John Rossoff was my camp counselor in the summer of 1971. May she rest in peace. And that's the news of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Binyamin Cohen, is the son of an Orthodox rabbi who married the Jew-by-choice daughter of a former Christian minister, founder and editor of the award-winning national magazine American Jewish Life and the online magazine Jews Week. It's written for a number of publications, including The Huffington Post, The Daily Beast, The Washington Post, and Slate. Prior to that, he edited Torah from Dixie, which was later turned into a book by the same name. He is now the content director for Mother Nature Network and the author of the highly entertaining book, My Jesus Year. Good morning again.
Hey, how are you?
Well, tell me, what, you know, in the course of your experiences, which included, as I recall, one religious service that met in a, I don't want to say a strip club, but... you know, there were Christian services everywhere of all kinds of ilks. Talk about what was the most interesting for you.
Probably the most bizarre place I went to was something called Ultimate Christian Wrestling, which was basically overweight men in tights. And it was kind of like the wrestling that we see on television where it's, you know, fake wrestling. And, you know, there's a storyline and there's drama unfolding. It's like a soap opera. There's the hero, there's the villain. And this was a similar concept where it was, you know, fake wrestling, and but you had people who were the heroes, and they were, you know, Christians, and you had people who were the villains, and those were the atheists, and they battled it out. And at the end of the night, you know, obviously the good beat the evil, and they actually, it was an evangelical event, and they had people accept Jesus at the end of the event, and people who were inspired and became born-again Christians at the end of the evening, which I found incredibly fascinating that people would be so inspired by watching fake wrestling to actually, you know, convert religions.
Well, do you think we should institute, I mean, you know, part of this was a goal of making Judaism more referable. Should we institute ultimate Jewish wrestling now?
You know, even at the wrestling, I think there are some things we can learn. I mean, they do market themselves very well. You know, wrestling may be a little comical to you and me, but maybe there are things that synagogues can do. Not too long ago, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post where I wrote some ideas of what synagogues can learn from churches. And one of the things that I saw at a lot of churches, for example, was something as simple as first-time visitor parking. Next to the handicapped spot in the front of the parking lot, they had a few spots that said first-time visitor only. And, you know, like when you go to the grocery store and they have, like, new mother parking. It's just something as simple as that that makes newcomers feel welcome. Again, I'm not talking about bringing Jesus into synagogue. I'm not talking about bringing any of the theological stuff. But simple things like marketing and member retention that churches do very well that it would, I think it would behoove synagogues to learn from.
I've always thought that the mega churches know a whole lot more about how to use technology effectively than we do. And we Jews are, even though we're so involved in technology in our own private lives, in fact, coming in on Yom Kippur, watching all the people on their Blackberries while I chant the Hineni is always an interesting experience. But somehow we don't move that over.
Yeah, on an individual level, yeah. You people check their Blackberries during services and all sorts of things like that.
You know, in The Year of Living Biblically, A.J. Jacobs talks about his experience, and he, you know, he does it in this sort of humorous way. And yet he gets some serious ideas and he changes a bit over it. It seems to me like you had, in some ways, by exploring Christianity, a kind of a similar, I hate to use the word epiphany, that it connected you more with your Judaism. Talk about how you felt going into this and then how you felt coming out of it.
Absolutely. I really, you know, I grew up, like you said at the beginning, the son of an Orthodox rabbi. All my siblings became rabbis or married rabbis, and I'm the only one that didn't go into the family business.
You're the black sheep.
They wear black hats.
They're the black hats. You're the black sheep, or you're the white. Never mind.
I'm the white sheep.
You're the white sheep.
So either way, yeah. So, you know, I really felt like growing up, Judaism was forced down my throat. You know, I had to keep kosher. I had to keep the Sabbath. I had to do all these things. And as a rabbi, you know, that's not the way to, you know, get someone to be religious, is to force it down. You know, if you want someone to be religious and stay religious, it has to be it's a personal decision. And I didn't feel I had that decision. So the point of this year for me was not to explore Christianity to convert to Christianity, but it was to explore Christianity to, you know, to tap into that spirituality that I noticed, you know, because people go there every Sunday, and find out what it is and bring it back to my own Judaism. So like I said, I can get more jazzed about my Judaism. And I think it really worked in that sense. You know, I found some great things that they do at churches, whether it's the music or the marketing or membership retention, all these things. One example I'll tell you is I really had one of the most spiritual places I went to was a small Episcopal church that only had 30 people. And it was such a nice way to have a conversation with God, was in this small environment, not in a huge sanctuary. And the synagogue my wife and I belong to is a big synagogue, has about 400 or 500 members on a Saturday morning. And we actually switched synagogues, and now we belong to a much smaller synagogue that only has 30 people on a Saturday morning because of what I experienced in the Episcopal church, because it reminded me, you know, that's a nice way to have to pray to God. Not different strokes for different folks. Some people may enjoy the larger pomp and circumstance. But for me, what I learned at the church was I like the smaller experiences. And I really think, I mean, that was just one of the many things I learned over the year. I figured that the church, the grass is not always greener at the church across the street. You know, I learned to appreciate a lot of the stuff that we have in Judaism, and it kind of gave me a fresh perspective. All these Christians that I met, many of them were Christian Zionists who were fascinated with Jews and they were asking me questions about Judaism, and it kind of gave me a sense of pride that, you know, here I was asking them questions, and they were really more interested in asking me questions about my own religion. So I kind of learned a lot of lessons along the way, and I think I'm a more appreciative Jew. I still don't have all the answers, but I think I'm a little closer to finding those answers.
The you know, in your bio you talk about your wife, so I guess it's fair game. You married a woman who is the daughter of a Christian minister. I'm sure that your parents were thrilled about that when that started.
You know, I actually met her while she was in the middle of converting to Judaism. So I actually met her at synagogue one Saturday morning.
So you go to shul and you meet the daughter of a minister.
Oh, I see this beautiful blonde-haired, you know, Aryan-looking woman. I'm like, who are you? you know, so the truth is my parents are actually very happy because she is, in many ways, more religious than I am, because she chose Judaism. You know, I feel, as many Jews who are born into Judaism, you know, it's something that's a yoke on our shoulders. But here's someone who chose it, and I really, almost like by spiritual osmosis, I love living with someone like that who is so enthusiastic. You know, I got to experience her first Passover and her first Hanukkah and her first Sabbath, and I got to see all these things through her eyes. And she, you know, is so much more strict about a lot of things, you know, because she doesn't want to mess up at all. And so she really keeps me in line. So actually, my parents are actually very happy that I married someone like that, as opposed to someone who is maybe more cynical like I am.
You know, you thank a variety of rabbis for putting you on the path to writing this book, My Jesus Year. Now, assuming you're not counting Jesus as one of those rabbis. So tell me how rabbis directed you in this path.
Like I said, I grew up, you know, the son of a rabbi, and I looked at rabbi, you know, my dad as the ultimate rabbi, and, you know, it was very much in a communal fashion, you know, always ministering to the people. But a lot of the rabbis I think in the book are people who opened my eyes, in a sense, of other things that Judaism can be. You know, Judaism for me growing up was a family business. And so it wasn't a religious thing for me. It was
That's my line. You're stealing my line here.
I'm sorry.
My dad's a rabbi. My grandfather's a rabbi. My great uncle's. Never mind. Go ahead. It's all right. Use it. It's okay. I'll live.
I'll credit you next time.
Nice. Thank you.
But, you know, many other rabbis who I had, rabbis as teachers or rabbis in my synagogue or rabbis I met during this trip, you know, they weren't, in a good way, they weren't my dad, because I was able to look at them more as a spiritual guide than as a father figure.
Well, it's a great delight. The book is called My Jesus Year. It's by Binyamin Cohen. You can find it wherever books are sold, which is nowadays mostly online. I want to thank Binyamin Cohen for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Ari Roth, the director of Theater J, the most innovative Jewish theatrical program going on in the country. Our play out this morning on Too Jewish, in the spirit of our pro-immigration Jewish history, comes from the group Hip Hop Judios, and it's called 1492. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.